Okay, I am not Martin Murray, so if you're expecting him, my apologies, he couldn't make it. My name is Brian Hurley, and I'm from Detroit Industrial Underground, and I'm doing a speech on internet radio today, and the legalities of that. And as I was printing it out, my computer died, or my printer died. Thank you, fucking Bill Gates. So I lost half of my speech, so I'll be doing that half of memory, so it should be interesting. But if you guys have any questions, just feel free to jump in. Okay, as I said, I'm from Detroit Industrial Underground, and I've been an internet broadcaster for 4 years. And today I'm going to talk about the legalities of internet radio and the politics of that, as well as some thoughts on using the press and being used by the press. Now, do you guys listen to internet radio? Cool. Where are you broadcasting it?
Shoutcasting on 24 kilobits.
Excellent. Okay, just to give you some background, terrestrial radio, which is over-the-air radio, pays about 3 to 5% of their revenue to what's called performance rights organizations. And those are like CSAC, ASCAP, and BMI, and those guys. And so the rates we're facing on the internet are entirely different class of royalties. And that goes back to our friend, the DMCA, which in 1998 said that internet radio was not a performance, but in effect a copying. So that made a legal association between that and file sharing. And then it said that you could broadcast on the internet, but you would have to pay a fee to be determined at some future point, and that fee would be retroactive to 1998, which is where we get our statutory licensing and all that. And the way that was determined is by what's called a CARP, which is a Copyright Arbitration Royalty Panel. And let me give you some background on that. Most broadcasters were expecting a percentage of revenue model, like with the performance rights organizations. And like I said, that's between 3 and 5% per year of the revenue. And to participate in the CARP, you had to pay an equal share. So that, let's say I wanted to participate in the CARP, I could have a voice in that as long as I was willing to pay as much as Disney and Microsoft and AOL and all these other companies. And the cost of that was in the six figures, but they wouldn't tell you what it was in advance. So as you might guess, most of the people who signed up wound up dropping out. And so basically the only voices in that process were, like I said, the RIAA, Microsoft, I think Apple was on there, Real, you know, the RIAA members. And as you might expect with that group, you're going to get a settlement that reflects their needs and not like small broadcasters like him or I or anybody else like that. And so what the CARP finally did was that they were supposed to do what's called a willing buyer, willing seller model, which is to basically, if I want to buy it and you want to sell it, what price would we agree on? And they're supposed to set that price for the entire industry. And so they looked at 26 deals, and they wound up projecting 25 of those because they said that the RIAA had stacked those deals basically in favor of itself to prejudice the process. And so the only deal they wound up considering was one between Yahoo and the RIAA, which was negotiated back in 1999. Now, you may recall that time period was the height of the dot-com boom. And, afterwards, of course, all that stuff went down the toilet and was worth nothing. But at that point, Yahoo Radio was worth $5 billion. And so that was where they were coming from, you know, financially speaking. So they could afford to spend some big bucks on that. And so then on February 20th of last year, the CARP finally released its findings after months of deliberation and like 15,000 pages of testimony and whatnot. And what they came up with is 0.07 cents per song per listener for a terrestrial radio station, which is over-the-air radio. And then 0.0014 cents per song per listener for internet radio. So in other words, internet radio is paying double the price to broadcast over the internet as a regular radio station would. And you know, they had no rationale for that. But that was their rulemaking. And they also had what's called an ephemeral recording fee, which is like a surcharge for temporary recordings, which means MP3s. So just the fact that you were running an MP3 station meant you had to pay an extra 8.8% on top of your other fees. And what that worked out to per listener per year, let's say a 20 listener capacity or 10 listener capacity, it was $191 per listener per year, retroactive. You assume you have a listener going 24 hours a day. And if you compare that to a terrestrial radio station, a terrestrial station with 100,000 listeners at once would pay about $1,000 a year for their ASCAP, CSAC, and BMI fees. And so under CARP, a station with 5 listeners would pay as much as a 100,000 listener terrestrial station, you know, sort of comparing, you know, historically speaking. And there was a $500 minimum on top of that as well. So as you might guess, we weren't too happy about that. I'm also going to cover the reporting requirements. You guys follow these issues with internet radio and the RIAA at all? Okay. Let's see. They wanted the name of the service, the station ID. This is for every song, by the way. The type of program, whether it was archived or looped, date and time of transmission, time zone. Numeric designation of the sound recording number within the program, like whatever song in the playlist it was, number. How long it was, the title, the ISRC code, which I never did find out what that means. The release year of the album and the copyright information. The featured recording artist, the retail title of the album, the recording label, the UPC code, the catalog number, and the copyright owner information, and the musical genre. And that's for every single song. And with things like copyright owner, you can't look at a CD and tell who owns a copyright. You know, it may say, such and such company owns it, but that's been sold 3 times, and you're supposed to track all this information down somehow. Every single song. Yeah, and so we kind of went ballistic over that whole. It was nuts. And the way terrestrial radio records their stuff, you know, for like ASCAP and BMI, is every year they keep a diary for 2 weeks. And that's all they have to do. Write down what songs they played 2 weeks out of the year. And for each listener, they also wanted a bunch of information. Let's see. They wanted the name of the service or entity, like we can track that down somehow. What channel program it was. The date and time the user logged in the user's time zone, time they logged out in their time zone, a unique user identifier, which I know Real and Microsoft has those, but Shoutcast does not. Not to mention, you know, XMMS through Linux, so we can't track that information. We don't have it, and there's no way to get it. And the country the user received the transmission in, which, once again, how do you get that information? You know, sometimes an IP address will tell you, sometimes it won't. And so, you know, the effect of all that was to give free market research to the RIAA, and there were no stipulations that they couldn't use that for any purpose they wanted to. So in other words, you're doing the mix of, you're creating a mix and getting an audience, and then you're telling them who your audience is, what mix you're playing, how many people listen to each song, so you're doing all the demographics for them, and basically giving up your business if you have one. Well, bear in mind, this is what the standards were as of February 20th of last year. They basically said you had to report them once a month to them. And they didn't settle on the format, whether it's going to be some sort of compressed format or text or whatnot. And in fact, they still have not decided those questions. And, like, you know, you hear that guy next door. He may have the same size audience that he or I has, but he's not, you know, writing down your IP addresses or logging where you're from or your time zone or paying $500 a year minimum and stuff like that, which is why I want to get more into the club DJing, because that's a pain. Let's see. So as far as the reactions to that, you know, we were pretty much in shock. The worst case scenario was what people were planning for is maybe 10% of revenue, which was like double the CSAC, ASCAP, BMI. And actually, if you compare that, now, in the U.S., terrestrial radio does not pay performance royalties or over-the-air royalties. They pay the ASCAP, CSAC, and all that, but they do not pay the copyright holders, which is like the record company or the RAA. And in European countries, they do pay, but they pay a smaller percent than the CSAC and ASCAP and all that. So in total, they're paying less than 10% on the average of royalties, even to both types of organizations. And the people who did have revenue estimated that this was like 200% of their annual revenue, which, you know, that's not a business model anyone can live off of. So we kind of went from the shock to the outrage thing, and you know, we organized some protest. And the biggest one was the Day of Silence, which was on May 1st of last year. There was two things. There was a Day of Silence, and there was the Save Internet Radio Marathon. They were both on the same day, so either most stations were either silent or running the protest broadcast. And that did pretty good. We got like 120,000 listeners total, and there were 22,000 faxes sent to Congress. And so that actually got their attention. And the Library of Congress rejected the CARP thing on May 21st, but he didn't give an explanation for why. He basically said, well, I'll get back to you on June 20th with the final results. Did you have a question? Okay, sorry. And so we were hopeful about that. But then on June 20th, he came out with his final ruling, and basically the only change he made was he cut the internet radio rate in half to what the terrestrial radio stations were paying. So it was still the so it was down to 0.07 cents per song per listener, which works out to about $91 a year for one person listening all year long, which is still, you know, pretty outrageous. Yeah. Well, that depends on how much would you pay for, you know, to listen to the radio. Well, see, people don't like to pay on the internet. Yeah, they want. I mean, we all want free. Free's good. And if I did implement a subscription model on my station, there would be other stations you guys would switch over to and say, well, why should I pay him when I can go to this guy who's in Canada or something and listen to his stuff. So. And even in those stations, the bigger ones, which did have revenue, like I said, it was like a couple hundred percent of their revenue in royalties. So it's not viable. Did one of you guys have a question there? Well, there are a few ways to fight it. One way was to go to court, and of course, going to court costs a lot of money. Actually, if you send me a link, I'll send you a debate I had on Slashdot with the head of the EFF, which thought basically that the idea of compulsory licensing, which is what all this is about, is basically communistic to begin with. And you may think it is or isn't, but it's a precedent going back to the 1930s. So we're not going to change law going back that far because the head of the EFF doesn't like it. But that was, and maybe he wasn't speaking in official capacity, but he struck me as a real idiot. I mean, he didn't understand at all about radio or internet radio or licensing or any of those other things. He didn't appreciate the idea of a compulsory license. Basically, what he said was that if a record company doesn't want you to play their stuff, you shouldn't be able to play it. But that means you're in a position where you have to go to every single record company and say, can I play this song? And that's not a position that over-the-air radio is in. And so once again, it's creating this, okay, why is it this way for these guys and this way for us? He did not see the logic. Yeah? Well, the DMCA defined internet radio as a distribution of music, not a broadcast of music. Yeah, they're basically saying that I'm distributing music out rather than broadcasting it. That's a good question. Why would it be? But where's my water at? Okay. The RIAA will claim a few things. They'll say that internet radio is a perfect digital copy, which anyone who's listening to internet radio knows that is not the case. You know, I rip at about 256 constant bit rate, and I broadcast 96K, so there's two intermediate steps of degradation going on there, even for a 96K station. And so it's nowhere near perfect, and even if you assume, well, technology is going to improve, whatever, 2, 5, 10 years down the road, it will be perfect, that raises another question, because you all heard of digital radio, right? Like over-the-air radio? Digital over-the-air radio is exempt from paying royalties as well. What's that? Well, yeah, but it's you could argue that's a perfect digital copy as well. Oh no, it's fine. I'm basically, I tend to go through stuff pretty fast, so I have a lot less material than we'll go for an hour. So, by all means, feel free to chime in. But it just kind of goes to show the hypocrisy, though, that. Okay, we've got one standard for, you know, let's say you're an over-the-air station, okay? You're broadcasting over the air. You don't pay these fees to the RIAA, but you pay the fees for your internet stream because the RIAA claims that they don't have promotional value.
You're broadcasting the same stream if you're in a terrestrial station and an internet radio station.
Right.
Broadcasting the same stream.
The exact same stream. Okay. Well, any over the internet stream is subject to paying royalties.
Okay.
Now,
it's the same exact.
The same exact music does not cost you to broadcast over the air, but costs you over the internet.
Okay.
And that's the idiocy of their argument because, you know, they're just like they're on crack or something. But if you look at the pattern of what they're doing with these laws, they basically want to shut down internet broadcasting. And the reason they do is, well, they want to restrict it to a certain few companies. And the reason for that is they want market consolidation because it's more economical for a record company to have, you know, a few major internet streams than, say, 40 or 50,000, which is the current situation. And so if you can eliminate, you know, the obscure genres and force everyone to listen to, say, Britney Spears or whatever, or one of those horrible jazz guys like Kenny G, then you know, you can make more money by carrying fewer titles. Let's see. Okay, now we're getting to the part where my printer died. So... Now, there was a big stink in the webcasting community over this, of course, and one of the things that happened was a group called Voice of Webcasters formed, and I joined those guys back in June because they said that they were trying to lobby for, like, better rates for everyone, all the internet broadcasters. And after a couple months on that list, they revealed that they were working with the RIAA. So that is a subset of the Voice of Webcasters, not the entire, like, 200-member group. And at the time, a lot of people were upset, and I thought, well, they have a right to deal with them if they can, you know, to make a private deal, as long as they separate their private agenda versus their public agenda for everybody. As it turns out, they did not keep those agendas separate. What?
So does like the RIA Feds realize that if they, you know, just had the same rates for both terrestrial internet broadcasting, that, you know, I wouldn't have problems, you know, like in that station, you know, place and stuff has occasional ads to pay for, you know, the rate and stuff, like just like basically running like a terrestrial place.
Well, here's what why terrestrial stations don't pay to broadcast over the air. Back in the 30s, the RIA's predecessors tried the same thing they did with the internet now, and they tried to force terrestrial stations to pay, you know, a percent of revenue, an extra percent. And what happened was the stations stopped playing the music altogether. You know, they switched to all independent stuff. And eventually they wound up, you know, I forgot what it was called back then, but the equivalent of the RIA caved in, and then the broadcasters got written into law that they would be able to play music royalty-free. And as I said earlier, they still have to pay the songwriters, which is ASCAP, CSAC, and BMI. And the argument is that, you know, the songwriters don't have any other way to make money, whereas the people who sell the records, the copyright holders, get in effect what's free advertising over the radio. And so, you know, that's called the promotional benefit argument, that okay, you get free advertising, therefore you don't got to pay royalties. So the RIAA's claim is that that promotional benefit argument does not apply to the internet. Yeah, why? But and they specifically mentioned in their CARP testimony that there are so many genres out there that they feel somehow it dilutes it. For example, they gave like the Bruce Springsteen example. If I run a station playing all Bruce Springsteen, no one's going to run out and buy Bruce Springsteen. Well, I think that's a stupid argument, but even so, the DMCA prohibits running an all Bruce Springsteen station. It makes you play, it says you cannot play so many artists within a certain time period, you can't do so many in a row, you can't publish your playlist in advance. There's all sorts of restrictions that internet radio has that terrestrial radio does not. And the other arguments are stupid, and it's you can't ask me to make sense out of them for you. I don't think it's going to improve without some sort of legislation or legal action or a defection away from the RIA material. And the reason is, you know, we've seen the DMCA, and how many times has that been challenged in court successfully? I mean, very few, or if so, they've been very limited victories. But the thing, you know, the reason that we hate the DMCA is the reason the politicians and big business loves it, because it gives them control over how we use technology. And this is a battle for control. No, you know, don't have any doubt about that. They want to control the distribution, and when they want to restrict it, you know, to move things more toward a mass market on the internet. And like, if you look at terrestrial radio, I think it was 1996 Telecom Reform Act. They basically removed the restrictions on terrestrial radio stations in a given market. So it used to be you could own 2 stations. Now you can own 8. So all 8 stations in Detroit could be owned by one company. Yeah, but if Clear Channel owns the rock, the classic rock, the soft rock, the rap, the alternative, it's pretty much sewn up. And what happens is we went from 70 radio networks to 2 within a 3-year period. And that's a very few people controlling what a lot of people listen to. And one of the consequences of that was there was this big feeding frenzy, and like radio station prices went up dramatically. And of course, if prices go up, you have to raise your ad rates. Then revenue drops. You got to cut expenses, which means you get rid of your local staff and DJs and run things. You do central programming then, which means you may have one group of people, 2 or 3 people, programming hundreds of radio stations. So. That effect is more media consolidation, less variety. And I don't see that changing anytime in the foreseeable future. Let's see, where was I at here?
Your printer must have died of despair.
I'm sorry?
Your printer must have died of despair.
Yeah. I'm going to take an axe to that thing when I get home. So let's see. We were basically up to June when I joined the Voice of Webcasters last year. And now, as I said earlier, the entire rate structure was based on one deal with the RAA and Yahoo, which they had bought Broadcast.com, and then that became Yahoo Radio. Now, in the Radio Internet Newsletter, a guy named Mark Cuban, who owns the Dallas Mavericks, and he also founded Broadcast.com, he wrote a letter saying that he was in on those initial negotiations with the RAA when he was still at before he left Broadcast.com. And he said his goal was to make it as expensive as possible for other stations to compete with his. So in other words, we had this entire thing is based on one deal, and that deal was based on both parties trying to screw everybody else over. Yeah, and you know, once again, I'm on my notes here, but one of the things that Cuban said was he wanted to make it only economical for the aggregators of content, such as his company, to be able to stream. And he also planned on using multicast technology because he had a big multicast network. But, and he wrote this, and I can give you the link if you want to read it. He said that they were just going to report the one connection from a multicast server to the RAA and then multicast out from there. Sorry. And so he planned on defrauding the RAA as well. So, yeah, the guy's a complete scumbag. He's betrayed everyone he's dealt with, you know. I mean, he cut a deal with broadcasters to do their streams. You know, then he wound up selling that company, in effect selling their product to Yahoo, and tried to screw the RAA. Then he publicly, you know, in effect betrayed Yahoo, who he sold this thing to for like $4.7 billion. Billion. Actually, it was 5.7, sorry. Well, I mean, obviously he's a good businessman. If you can, you know, you can scam your way up to this money, sell it, dump, and then run. So if you value that kind of behavior, then he should be applauded. Personally, I don't, but... So that was a Cuban story. So then we get back to what us webcasters were doing to try to get better rates. And we put forward something called the Internet Radio Fairness Act, and that was with Vowel. And basically, that thing died a very quick death. And part of that was due to the fact that the congressman who put it forward, you know, he didn't do it in a way that they liked, so they basically killed his bill. So that thing was dead. And then we came up with the H.R. 5469, which was the Small Webcaster Amendment Act. And the purpose of that was, it was a two-paragraph bill. And if you guys have ever read any laws, two paragraphs is nothing. That's like the boilerplate, okay. There was effectively one line to it, and that line said, these carp rates, which were supposed to take effect on October 20th, will be delayed for 6 months while the legal challenges go through. And we settled the details of how the record, the reporting works and all that fun stuff. So it was a very simple bill. Now, remember, the Voice of Webcasters had also revealed that they were negotiating with the RAA. And this is where the timing gets very interesting, because we were introduced, they sprung this 5469 on us on a Thursday, and I think that was like September 12th or so, and it was coming up for a vote on Monday or Tuesday. And, you know, most legislation has a multi-month long track. It doesn't introduced on Thursday, vote on Monday, you know. unless it's screwing us over, okay. If it's bad, it goes through fast. And that should be a sign right there.
Well, really bad, because most of it is bad.
Yeah, Patriot Act sucks, but is someone doing a panel on that? If not, they should. Now, as it turns out, they were trying to reach a settlement. Now, this is a group of 12 people in the Voice of Webcasters, and we're talking about basically the large internet radio stations, RadioIO.com, Beethoven.com, Digitally Imported, Wolf FM, 3WK, people like those. And they asked us to support this bill very vigorously. They said, you got to fax Congress, you got to nag your neighbors, you got to do this, you got to do that. And so basically we did. We harassed the hell. We called Congress. We faxed them. We asked our listeners to do the same thing. We nagged our family members and our friends and musician contacts and all that fun stuff. And so the thing came up for a vote a few days later. And actually, it did not come up for vote. It got shot down before it even got to that stage. But, and this is getting into some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, what Sessenbrenner, who is chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, he was the one who introduced this bill. And it was introduced just to put pressure on the webcasters and the RAA. And he said to them, you will settle or you'll get screwed down the road. So, now what kind of deal do you think they would come up with if someone put a gun to your head like that and said you're going to settle with the RAA and you're going to do it within like a whatever 3 or 4 day period? You're going to get a pretty bad deal. And what came out of this is then this bill, which was the two paragraph bill, was rewritten by the RAA into a 30-page bill. And then that went through Congress within 7 minutes of being introduced. And the congressman who voted on it did not read it. They thought they're voting on the two-paragraph version. And so that pissed us off. And I don't have the date on that, but we're getting toward October. It took like a couple weeks for all that to go through in the negotiations. But some problems with that bill is that, you know, they were negotiating privately all along. They were never negotiating for the webcasting community as a whole. And it was, as I said, like 12 stations, which for the most part were in a pretty narrow market segment. You know, what they call small commercial webcasters, what I would call a large commercial webcaster. And we're talking people with maybe 2,000 or 3,000 listeners at once capacity. And as a side note, they do not pay for their bandwidth. Most of them get it from like AOL, which, you know, Nullsoft makes Winamp and Shoutcast. They give away a lot of free bandwidth to the bigger stations. So these are people who, to start with, had a somewhat better business model than most of us do because, like I said, they're not paying for their biggest supply item. But so that deal was never meant to be, you know, written into law. And they did not have any hobbyist webcasters or any non-commercial webcasters or educational webcasters. It was just, okay, these few people and that's that. And it was difficult to read. I mean, 30 pages is hard to read anyways, but it was written in a form of search and replaces to copyright law. So they'd say, like, strike this sentence in paragraph 6B in the copyright law section, blah, 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 replace it with such and such. Well, that's a bit hard to make sense out of. But there was a suspicion among a lot of us that it foreclosed legal appeals to the CARP process. And another concern was that, you know, Congress felt that if they'd solved the internet radio problem, they would not be coming back to any time in the near future, which would leave the vast majority of us screwed. And what the settlement was, they come up with was, excuse me, there would be a $2,000 minimum per year. And I believe 12% of revenue on top of that. Well, 12% of revenue with $2,000 minimum. Now, this is a great deal for them because it effectively lowered their cost about 92%. And that's based on information provided by Radio I.O., which was, and the head of them was the main guy behind this deal. So I'm assuming that his numbers were pretty accurate. So they got a 92% discount, and the rest of us got nothing. And at this point, it also came out that the voice of webcasters who ran this list called the CARP list for all on said, well, yeah, you're not members of the voice of webcasters. You know, the voice of webcasters, all these 12 people doing this deal, and this is just a discussion group and yada, yada, yada. So they were, in effect, you know, using us to support their legislative goals, which, once again, pissed us off. This is pretty much an all pissed us off type story, but And now, I had known some of this beforehand because my name is Brian, and the Voice of Webcast switched to a new web hosting company, and one of their contacts' name was Brian, and somehow the guy screwed up and was copying me a lot of their emails. So he had sent me some stuff, with all the email passwords for one thing, the web hosting passwords. Now, most of you guys would have probably used that, but I did not use that particular information. But what I did use was a spreadsheet that he sent me, which listed all the various subgroups, the legislative committee, who was doing the deals and all that, and they weren't, it wasn't labeled, okay, this is the secret people negotiating with the RAA, but there was listed like a subset of 12 people, and they were the same people who were, they would do like tag teams on the group. Like, let's say that if I complained about something, rather than this guy doing it, this person would respond, and that person would respond, and that person would respond. And, you know, there was basically a whole disinformation campaign. And now, a woman named Ann Gabriel, who is the current president of the Webcaster Alliance, but at the time she was working with another group called the International Webcasting Association. And I'm sorry to introduce so many groups here, but it's like an Illuminati conspiracy thing. Now, yeah, and VAW was doing, I'm sorry, the IWA was doing a 20-day broadcast, which Ann was in charge of, to protest, you know, what was going on. That is the, not what the Voice of Webcasters had done, but the whole legal situation, trying to prove it for all of us. And when this information came out about what the Voice of Webcasters, you know, trying to cut a deal and making a law, Ann resigned from the International Webcasting Association because the IWA and VAW had the same lawyer. And so they were trying to, the IWA was raising money to, in effect, pay VAW's lawyer. And it's getting really sleazy at this point. And the IWA had not agreed to this. So their lawyer was somehow serving two clients at once with different sets of interest. Well, their president resigned. And but once again, we come down to who's going to sue who here. And who's going to pay for it? Now, so the crop list was going pretty nuts at this point. There's much bitching. This is a high volume list to begin with. So we could hit 200 or 300 messages per day. And so if you went away for a week, you were just hopelessly behind. And there was a bunch of mass resignations from it, and that's when I quit as well. And a couple dozen of people quit, and that's when they went off and formed another group, which was to become the Webcaster Alliance. And I, at that point, did not join them because I wanted to carry on my media attack against the Voice of Webcasters. And what I did was I got in touch with Andrew Orlowski at the Register, and he's written a lot of stuff which is anti-RAA, so I thought he'd be sympathetic to the whole cause. And it took a few emails to get through to him what was going on, but then once that happened, you know, he wrote some really sympathetic articles and interviewed some of the VAW people, and he referred to VAW as a cabal of 13, which was pretty accurate. And I also wrote some stuff to Slashdot and got a couple postings in there, but what's interesting about this is that only three publications have covered this split between the Voice of Webcasters and what they have done to the webcasting community, and that's The Register, The Inquirer, and Slashdot. You know, the mainstream media, and I'm talking about the people who specialize in internet radio, like The Washington Post and LA Times, have totally basically suppressed the story. And in fact, I got contacted by the LA Times. This was a few days after the Register articles began to come out. And so, of course, I said, well, where'd you hear from me at? He's like, well, I was just browsing the Shoutcast directory at random and came across your station. It's like, oh, what an amazing coincidence. So I called him up, and we talked for like 40 minutes. And, you know, he put forward to me all the RIA's arguments, the perfect digital copies argument, you know, the no promotional value thing and a couple other ones. And I gave what at the time, at least in my memory, was an excellent defense of attacking all their points. So then his article comes out the next day, doesn't mention any of those things that he grilled me about. But he gave Sound Exchanges, which is the RIAA's subsidiary for royalties, he printed all of their points of views, but none of my rebuttals. And it turns out, during our conversation, he told me that he knows Kurt Hansen, who runs the Radio Internet Newsletter. You guys ever read that? Well, RAIN is the biggest source of internet radio news, and they did a lot of good for the community until this story came out, in which case they did not mention the Register articles. They did not print Ann Gabriel's resignation letter. They did not print any of the stuff I sent them. They basically ignored the story as well. And when the Register came out with a couple articles, finally they said, well, they decided to run a piece on it. They just called it the pros and cons of 5469. And I know those guys, and normally what they do when they print something is they print an entire article to reproduce the whole thing. In this case, they just printed a couple sentences and just didn't link to them and described Ann Gabriel as a disgruntled employee and didn't mention the dozens of defections from the CARP list, and they were on that list too, so they knew exactly what was going on. Let's see, so the LA Times guy. So the LA Times wrote this piece, and what he did do was he wanted to put a face on hobbyist webcasters, and so he sort of made me their poster boy of this guy runs the station, this is what he does, this is how much he's going to owe. So in that sense, it was a good article. I mean, you know, national press is always a good thing if you're trying to get a message out. But clearly the guy has his own agenda, because I think I started getting to the fact that he knows the RAIN editors. He knows the Sound Exchange president, and he knows Bao's lawyer. So it's a small world, and where everyone knows each other. And then the next day after the LA Times piece came out, RAIN ran an article about me. Once again, I'm not hard to get a hold of on the internet, since I emailed them multiple times. So they wrote a piece about me and my station and did not contact me about it. And what they said was that I could become a nonprofit organization and get rates that were about, you know, 2/3 of the other rates. You know, as if that was some kind of solution. Now, to become a nonprofit, you know, you got to jump through a bunch of legal hoops. You have to have a board of directors. You know, I wouldn't do it without a lawyer. And so this idea that someone who wants to stream music, even if they do it, you know, fairly seriously, like myself as a hobbyist with no revenue, would probably spend thousands of dollars setting this crap up, and it's an uncertain process. But RAIN began this campaign to convince everyone that the CARP rates weren't so bad for stations of my size. And this is the same organization that was running screaming headlines about internet radio being killed by CARP. And we had some interesting private emails between me and a couple of the RAIN editors. And basically what they told me was that, you know, they want to do the most good for the biggest stations. But that gets into an assumption, though, because as far as I'm concerned, the CARP settlement, did any of you guys read the Register coverage of this a few months ago? Well, one of the headlines they ran was that 96% of stations would not be helped by this HF 5469 bill. And I did not give that information to the guy at the Register, but I wrote that post on the CARP list using some numbers that were supplied to me by some of the Vow gang. And what they countered with was, well, yeah, 96% of the stations may not be helped, but most of those are crap at the bottom. And if you look at it in terms of numbers of listeners and the percentage of listeners who are on these top stations, the numbers are pretty much reversed. You know, maybe 90% or so of the listeners covered by these stations would be, you know, quote-unquote benefited, assuming that you want those big stations to, you know, around, and they like them, which they must if they listen to them. And that's what comes to the crux of the issue, though, is the people at the Voice of Webcasters believe that internet radio is a mass medium, and so does the RIAA. So they share that goal in common, that they both groups want market consolidation. They want as few stations as possible out there. They want to make the rules so that the larger stations can survive and the smaller stations cannot. And that assumption is clear if you look at their published writings and, you know, the kind of laws they've negotiated and their private stuff as well. You know, various posts on the CARP list, private emails, things like that. Let's see. So You know, if you ever have to deal with the press, you know, look around and take the time to find a sympathetic journalist, and you know, they're going to mess up your message. You know, 90% of the time, even the ones who like you are probably going to mess it up. So that's where it's good to have web pages where you can at least rebut these people, like especially like Rain, who just basically, you know, ran a piece slandering me. And so I posted a rebuttal on my own website. I said, well, if you hear from Rain, take a look at this and read these other things, that stuff that they're not going to cover there. But a lot more people read Rain in the LA Times than read my webpage. Even if I did get slashed out two or three times. Let's see. So where I left off with the legal stuff, pardon me, is that HR 5469 version 2 had jumped from... Anyone know what time it is? Sorry? 3? So I got 3 minutes to go? Okay. I'll go into fast mode. Did you have a question? No, okay, I thought you had one. Okay. There was a bunch more protests, and so they introduced the newest version of version 3, which basically was the same as version 2, except they split off the negotiating part into like a separate section so that it wouldn't be written into law, but you know, a group was free to negotiate with the RAA, which of course turned out to be the voice of webcasters. So the group I'm in, the Webcaster Alliance, tried to, we came up with our own proposal, which they basically said, we don't have time to consider this. So they blew us off completely, and the voice of webcasters version got written into law. Let's see, I should go to the conclusion here, right?
So how do you protest those things effectively?
I'm sorry?
How do you protest those things effectively?
Well, we did send some people to Washington, actually. A bunch of people went to Washington, and our president of the Webcast Alliance has been to Washington a few weeks ago, and she's in touch with a lot of the legislative assistants of, like, Sessenbrenner, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And we are pursuing some legal alternatives, which I can't get into. That is, you know, there's some, I don't want to go there, but legislation, some legal options as well, and some public options, like public relations type things. We're launching a campaign called AIRR, which is the reverse of RAA, the American Internet Radio Revolution, which is going to get us some press. I mean, it's hard to fight these things because we're against people who have a lot of money and can effectively, you know, the RAA spends tens of millions of dollars per year buying laws. So, you know, we don't have that kind of cash. So you try to fight it through grassroots organizing, through finding sympathetic people, and you're just trying to get the word out. And if you guys want some more information, check out the webcasteralliance.com. And that's about all I got to say. Thanks.